stay there until he fell asleep, something that was frequently foiled when he tried to extract himself from the crib. Wayne Goodrich. The empathy that I felt for them at that moment in time, knowing that they would never really know or interact with their father as true adults, I felt very bad. Very bad. Very empathic. John Markov. Evie read The Crazy Ones in a clear voice. Eve Jobs, from the stage. Here's to the crazy ones, the misfits, the rebels, the troublemakers, the round pegs in the square holes, the ones who see things differently. They're not fond of rules, and they have no respect for the status quo. You can quote them, disagree with them, glorify or vilify them. About the only thing you can't do is ignore them. Because they change things. They push the human race forward. And while some may see them as the crazy ones, we see genius. Because the people who are crazy enough to think they can change the world are the ones who do. John Markov. I cried. Wayne Goodrich. The wave of emotion in the church was such that it was a conscious effort to even keep my perception about me, instead of just breaking down in a pool of my own tears. John Markov. Mona Simpson spoke and told of how she met her brother and about their relationship. It was much closer than I realized. She, too, talked about Steve's search for beauty. Mona Simpson. I remember when he phoned the day he met Laureen. There's this beautiful woman, and she's really smart, and she has this dog, and I'm going to marry her. John Markov. Joan Baez stood, and her guitar was brought out, and she sang Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. Mike Slade. She sat down with the guitar and played it. She hit the high note, and my spine shivered. I was just blown away. John Markov. Her voice is all still there. Mike Slade. She was 70, and it just blew everybody's doors off. John Markov. Bono and Slash sang. First Dylan's Every Grain of Sand, and then a U2 song, One. Mike Slade. Dylan was supposed to play the first song, and he blew them off. They asked him to play, and he said no. John Markov. To sing Dylan, Bono placed an iPad on a music stand to remember the words with. Bono. Singing Bob Dylan's song. I hear the ancient footsteps like the motion of the sea. Sometimes I turn, there's someone there. Other times it's only me. I am hanging in the balance of the reality of man. Like every sparrow falling, like every grain of sand. Mike Slade. And then, of course, Larry Ellison gave this big eulogy, which was, you know, funny and charming and kind of all about Larry. Larry Ellison. I wanted to talk about my friendship with Steve, what it was like, and a little bit about what Steve was really like. Mike Slade. Bill and I were kind of eye-rolling each other about Larry, because it had a lot of the pronoun I in it, shall we say, for a eulogy. But anyway, he meant well. John Markov. After the service, everyone filed out and walked across the oval to the Rodin Sculpture Garden. Ron Johnson. We get out of the church and the sun is starting to set and we've got a long walk, probably half a mile. It was just like a procession. Because everyone followed the same path. Wayne Goodrich. I don't remember who I walked over there with, but it was just very quiet. A lot of reflecting back. Numbness. Is this really happening? Did this just occur? And the questions of why start to seep in. Why now? Why here? Why? John Couch. It wasn't a boisterous drinking kind of thing. It was very sobering, just dealing with the fact of mortality of us as humans. Wayne Goodrich. Everybody had a little bit of a story about their time with Steve, and some people even managed to talk about it. All the stories that all the people there had about him would have been an amazing thing to somehow capture. My hair is standing up on my arm right now just thinking about it. Larry Brilliant. I met Steve Jobs because all of us hippies who had gone to India to hang out with gurus were very poor, and we got very skinny, and we never had any money to buy any food. And when one of us, any one of us, got a gig, then everybody would go find that person and say, "Hey, I knew you from the ashram, I'm hungry," or something like that. I got a gig, my gig was at the United Nations, and so I was working at the WHO office in Delhi, and by the time Steve came in 74, the cafeteria had gotten a reputation for having good, safe lettuce. So Steve showed up looking for lettuce, and I took him to lunch, and he inhaled lettuce. He inhaled the salad. He was trying so hard to eat only living food, and in India, the best and the healthiest thing you can do with food is to make sure it's dead, killed, boiled. So he was constantly getting sick, getting skinnier, and I just remember the first meeting we had was contentious, because I, at that time, was eating liver. I had been a vegetarian for almost 10 years, and I didn't feel like I had much energy, which was fine when I was in the ashram, but it wasn't so fine when I thought that if I didn't give an extra hour of work that day, then maybe babies would die of smallpox. I was skinny, vegetarian, and my boss said, "Oh, having a little trouble keeping up, eh?" She said, "Eat liver." Of course, there was no cow liver, being India. So you eat buffalo liver. So my first meeting with Steve was a debate between eating buffalo liver in order to get enough calories so that you could fight longer to stop more children from dying from smallpox, or eating living food because the planet would be better off in the long run if you only ate living food. And it was a great conversation. Steve Wozniak. Steve Jobs was very different before we started Apple. Personality settles in around age 20. So going to India was before that. When we started Apple and he was the founder of a company that had money, it was, "I'm going to be in a suit. I'm going to be on the covers of magazines. I'm going to be the one that will get credit for it." Steve had changed so much. John Couch. One of the stories that I tell is from when we were very close to each other in the early Lisa days. And you know, Steve was a minimalist. He had a beautiful English Tudor home. He had a Maxfield Parrish painting. He had a Tiffany lamp. He had a Swedish sound system. And then he had a mattress on the floor and a dresser. And I walked up to the house one day, and it was always impeccable. But there was a piece of paper on the front lawn, and I thought, "Well, that's really strange." And I picked it up. And it was an Apple stock certificate. 7.5 million shares of stock. And I knocked on the door and I said, "Steve, I think this belongs to you." And he goes, oh, yes. And he just kind of opened the dresser drawer and he put it in and he closed it and he said, "It must have blown out the window." And so I knew from that point on that it was never about money for Steve. Steve Wozniak. He wanted to be one of those important people that really changed things, like from that Ayn Rand book, and that led him to exclude everything else. He wanted to do it his way. He was always fighting me. Mike Slade. I'll tell you my last Steve Jobs story. Okay, so I love marketing, right? And one of the reasons I love it is that it's a lot of bullshit. And so I'm at Microsoft, and Steve is trying to get me to come to work at Next. And so we're sitting there talking, and he's telling me, "You're going to rot up there in Seattle. It rains all the time. It's beautiful in Silicon Valley." And he was saying, "You know, Mike, Palo Alto is a special place." He goes, "Palo Alto is like Florence in the Renaissance. You walk down the street and you meet an astronaut and a scholar, blah, blah, blah." I'm like, "Yes, that sounds cool." So I come to work for Next. And so my wife and I, we didn't have kids yet, and so we'd eat a lot at Il Fornaio on University Avenue in Palo Alto. We were sitting there in early 91, and I'm reading the menu, And on the back of the menu at Il Fornaio, it says, Palo Alto is like Florence in the Renaissance. And it goes through the whole spiel. The fucking guy sold me a line from a menu from a chain restaurant. Bad ad copy from Il Fornaio, which was his favorite restaurant, right? Such a shameless bullshitter. John Rubinstein. Steve was a very complicated individual, very complicated. There were so many aspects of him. I mean, he was so passionate about product. Not just our products, but products in general. He was really good at choosing a path. Not a long-term path. This isn't a vision thing. This is, you get to a fork in the road, what fork do you take? He surrounded himself with good people and kept them motivated through both the good times and the bad times. He was a good marketing guy. He could sell ice cubes to Eskimos, right? When he was in front of an audience, it didn't matter if it was 10 people or 10,000 people. Everyone felt like Steve was speaking directly to them. And that's a remarkable talent. Alvy Ray Smith. This will sound like a sick comparison, but Hitler had this articulate speech thing, too. Steve had this charisma that was just awesome. But to misuse that is evil. And I think he was evil. Larry Brilliant. I saw the behavior that people described as mercurial and peremptory and harsh. But 17,000 people worked for him and would have killed to continue working for him because he made them better. Steve Wozniak. But people close to Steve had to deal with just wrong behavior. John Rubinstein. Steve had all kinds of issues, but he had a bunch of really, really important gifts that allowed him to accomplish the things he wanted to accomplish. Ron Johnson. I think even Steve recognized that the measure of life is not time, it's impact. And Steve's impact is as profound as anybody who has walked this planet. Steve Wozniak. Look, I came up with the product that made Apple. If Steve Jobs had started without me, where would he have gone? Keep in mind, Steve tried to make 4 computers in his life, with millions of dollars, and they all failed. The Apple III for marketing reasons, the Lisa because Steve didn't understand costs, the Macintosh, which wasn't really a computer, just a program that looked like a computer, and led to big problems later on, and the next. John Markov. Still, Steve was emblematic of the Valley, rising to represent how it touched the popular culture. He is the vector for Alan Kay's insight. Kay was the person who understood that computing was a universal medium, that it wasn't a calculation tool, and as a universal medium, it transformed any medium that it touched. Before computing, there had been paper. There had been music, there had been video, and computing sort of relentlessly transformed each one of them. And Steve was the vector. He was the messenger who sort of implemented Alan's vision. Steve was the one who shaped those products so that they were usable by mortals, and so we could get beyond the original personal computers. And the modern world is different because of that. Steve Wozniak. I swear he didn't have to be a bad person. He didn't even have to be a controlling person, even a closed person, to create all the good technology he did. So he was good and bad. Wayne Goodrich. It got dark quite late. Stephen Levy. There was this beautiful moon hanging there, and it was perfectly clear. I said to Laureen, I bet Steve had a couple of earlier versions of the weather that he sent back until he came up with this. It was just a beautiful event. Ron Johnson. The Rodin Sculpture Garden is a very peaceful place. It's one of my favorite places to go sit at Stanford, and they had transformed it into almost like a nightclub. It was just really a lovely place to be. It was just this beautiful, beautiful setting, and the temperature is coming down, but there's a warmth and a freshness to the evening, and everyone just didn't want to leave. Wayne Goodrich. Then it just started thinning out, and everybody just kind of disappeared. Mark Benioff. And then we were all leaving, and on the way out they handed us a small brown box. And I received the box, and I said, "This is going to be good." Because I knew that Steve made a decision that everyone was going to get this. And so whatever this was, it was the last thing he wanted us to all think about. So I waited until I got to my car, and I opened the box. And what is the box? What is in this brown box? It was a copy of Yogananda's book. Andy Hertzfeld. They gave Autobiography of a Yogi to every attendee as they were leaving. It was kind of an interesting thing to do. Mark Benioff. Yogananda was a Hindu guru who had this book on self-realization, and that was the message. The message was, actualize yourself. Dan Kottke. I was actually surprised because Steve was much more of a fan of Zen mind, beginner's mind. That, I would say, is more his favorite book. Mark Benioff. Actualize yourself. That was Yogananda's message. And if you look back at the history of Steve, that early trip where he went to India to the ashram of his Maharishi, he had this incredible realization that his intuition was his greatest gift, and he needed to look at the world from the inside out. Larry Brilliant. You just wouldn't get a conversation with anybody else the way you would get it with Steve Jobs. You could be talking about politics. You could be talking about space travel. You could be talking about movies or music, technology, spiritual life. He was so smart, and his mind was so agile. And what he could do was he could take the experiences that he had with computers, or the experiences that he had with a mystical quest, and he could apply them to analyzing today's news, or to political events, or geopolitical events, even more so. I never had a conversation with him where I didn't learn something. Mark Benioff. And here his last message to us was, look inside yourself. Realize yourself. Look to the Autobiography of a Yogi, which is a story of self-realization. I think that is so powerful. It gives a tremendous insight into who he was, but also why he was successful. He was not afraid to take that key journey. Ron Johnson. Steve was clearly a spiritual being. Mark Benioff. He was the guru. Epilogue. The future is already here. It's just not very evenly distributed. William Gibson. The Endless Frontier. The Future History of Silicon Valley. They come west, seeking fame and fortune. They work their claims. Some even strike it rich. Swap the pickaxe for some coding chops and the six-shooter for a standing desk, and suddenly Silicon Valley becomes a much more familiar place. It is what it has always been, a frontier, the boundary between what is and what could be. It's a place where the future is dreamed up, prototyped, packaged, and ultimately sold. But what is the future of this place that makes the future? Where is Silicon Valley going? Where is its technology taking us? What are we to become? The best answers to those questions come from those who've already built the future, the one that we live in today. Kevin Kelly. The biggest invention in Silicon Valley was not the transistor, but the startup model. The culture of the entrepreneurial startup. Mark Porat. It's the style of thinking and behaving that's called being an entrepreneur. Megan Smith. I grew up in it. It's extraordinary. An entrepreneurial culture of like, hey, how can we solve this? And really caring about helping each other. Carol Bartz. It really is just this need to change as fast as possible to enable the next great thing. We don't even have to imagine the next great thing yet. We just have to get the tools to do something and use trial and error until we have the next great thing. Jim Clark. The venture capital business is a big part of that. They are in the business of betting on these people, and the good ones make money at it. Then it becomes kind of a self-fulfilling organism. Tony Fadell. That's going to be Silicon Valley's legacy. It has cast a mold, cast a die, for this ever-evolving way of taking up risk, taking on new ideas, funding them, and making things happen. Mark Porat. The elements that made Venice are the elements that made Palo Alto, are the elements that will make Silicon Valley, and it just grows and grows. Ev Williams. Once it gets started, then it just snowballs. Scott Hassan. I try not to predict the future very much, but the one thing I know for certain is that in the future there are going to be more computers. They're going to be faster, and they're going to do more things. Tony Fadell. You're going to see every single industry, no matter how behind the times they are, adopting technology. Deep technology. Scott Hassan. Eventually computers are going to do everything. I don't think anything is safe. Nothing. Tony Fadell. Change is going to be continual, and today is the slowest day society will ever move.
Christina Woolsey. Technology is changing fundamental things. It changes where you can live and work. It changes who you know. It changes who you can collaborate with. Commerce has completely changed. Those things change the nature of society.
Scott Hassan. Never, ever try to compete with a computer on doing something, because if you don't lose today, you'll lose tomorrow. Tony Fadell. Tomorrow will get faster, and every year after it's only going to continue to get faster in terms of the amount of change. That means all of these incumbents with these big businesses that have been around for 100 or 200 years can be unseated, because technology is the unseating element. Technology is the levelizer.
Carol Bartz. We are very arrogant out here that nothing can change unless technology is involved, and technology will drive any business out there to a disruption point.
Mark Porat. Technology. That's what we do here in Silicon Valley. We just push technology until someone figures out what to do with it. Andy Hertzfeld. Right now the Valley is particularly excited about two things. One of them is machine learning. Incredible progress has been made in machine learning the last 3 or 4 years. A broader way of saying it is artificial intelligence. Kevin Kelly. The fundamental disruption, the central event of this coming century, is going to be artificial intelligence, which will be underpinning and augmenting everything that we do. It will be pervasive, cheap, and ubiquitous.
Marissa Mayer. I'm incredibly optimistic about what AI can do. I think right now we are just at the early stages and a lot of fears are overblown. Technologists are terrible marketers. This notion of artificial intelligence, even the acronym itself is scary.
Tiffany Schlein.
There's all this hysteria about AI taking over, but here's the thing. The skills we need most in today's world, skills like empathy, creativity, taking initiative, and cross-disciplinary thinking, are all things that machines will never have. Those are the skills that will be most needed in the future, too.
Marissa Mayer.
If we'd had better marketing, we would have said, wait, can we talk about enhanced intelligence? Or computer-augmented intelligence? Where the human being isn't replaced in the equation?
The people who are working on artificial intelligence are looking at how they can take a repetitive, menial task and make a computer do it faster and better. To me, that's a much less threatening notion than creating an artificially intelligent being.
Andy Hertzfeld. You know, there wasn't so much a breakthrough algorithm that made it happen, although there was some improved algorithm work. Mainly it was just the ability to apply the algorithm to billions of data inputs. It was just a difference of scale. And so that scale just came naturally from Moore's Law. Alvy Ray Smith. Moore's Law is astonishing. It's beyond belief. It's the dynamo of the modern age. Andy Hertzfeld. It couldn't have happened no matter how brilliant your algorithm was 20 years ago, because billions were just out of reach. But what they found was that by just increasing the scale, suddenly things started working incredibly well. It kind of shocked the computer science world that they started working so good. Kevin Kelly. So just like the way we made artificial flying, we're going to make new types of thinking that don't occur in nature. It's not that it's going to be human-like, but faster. It's an alien intelligence, and that turns out to be its chief benefit. The reason why we employ an AI to drive our cars is because they're not driving it like humans. Jim Clark. It's bound to happen. The robotic driving of cars. Nolan Bushnell. Self-driving cars are going to change everything and help cities to literally become gardens, because streets in some ways kind of go away. Jaron Lanier. Once we have automated transportation, you might stop thinking about home in the same way. The idea is that everybody would be in self-driving RVs forever, so there would just be like this constant streaming of people living a mobile lifestyle, going from here to there all over the world. Why not? And indeed, there's something very attractive about that. I could see raising a family where you have a bunch of families with young kids of similar ages, all traveling together, seeing different parts of the world, convening for their education and working remotely. That could actually be really nice, because what we do these days is we spend hours a day moving kids around from this lesson to that school, to this soccer thing or whatever, and it's kind of an insane way to live. That makes no sense to anybody. And so I could imagine something that's actually pretty nice coming together. I like that vision a lot. Scott Hassan. I like the concept of self-driving cars, but I worry that our legal system can't really handle them. The problem with autonomous cars is that it's the manufacturer who was driving that car. Kevin Kelly. Humans should not be allowed to drive. We're just terrible drivers. In the last 12 months, humans killed 1 million other humans driving. Scott Hassan. If we can bring that down to, like, 3 a day, that will be amazing, right? It will be 1,000 times less, right? But the problem is those 3 deaths are going to be caused by an autonomous car killing them. And that could sink any company making autonomous cars, because the payout, 3 per day, that's a lot of lawsuits. So, from a liability point of view, it actually might be easier to skip over the autonomous driving cars and go direct to flying cars. It might actually be easier, because there's less liability involved. And so I think we're going to start seeing flying cars in the next 5 to 10 years. And then they're going to get widespread in like 20 to 30 years. Because the nice thing about a flying car is that all you have to do is convince one agency that it's cool, the FAA. And there's really nothing anyone can do about it, because if they say it's okay, then it's okay. Andy Hertzfeld. So the second thing Silicon Valley is particularly excited about right now is artificial reality. Or you might say mixed reality, or whatever you want to call it. Kevin Kelly. That VR vision of the alternative world is still there, but the new thing is this other version of augmented or mixed reality, where artificial things are inserted into the real world, whether they be objects or characters or people. Scott Hassan. VR blocks off your field of vision, and everything has to be reconstructed digitally. And so MR, which is mixed reality, is a technology that can selectively draw on any part of your vision. It can actually include all your vision, if that's what's required. So MR is, I believe, the next step in how we interface with computers and information and people. It's all going to be through mixed reality. And VR is a special case of mixed reality. Nolan Bushnell. All of this is on a continuum, and right now augmented reality is a little bit harder than virtual reality, technically. Steve Wozniak. Because of Moore's law, we always have more bits and more speed to handle those more bits on the screen. Well, we now have finally gotten to the point where we have enough computer power that you can put the screen on your head, and it's like you're living in a different world. And it fools you. It's enough to fool the brain. Nolan Bushnell. I've seen how technology has moved from Pong to what we're playing today. Then I expect the same kind of pathway to virtual reality. And I think that 20 years from now, we will be shocked at how good VR is. I like to say we are at the Pong phase of virtual reality. 20 years from now, VR is going to be old hat. Everybody will be used to it by then, maybe living there permanently.
Brenda Laurel. The only way I can see that happening is if we completely trash the planet.
Jim Clark. Nolan is a good friend. I know him well, and he can get hyperbolic. I do not think people are going to be living in virtual reality. That might be true in 100 years, not in 20. Nolan Bushnell. So when is VR indistinguishable from reality? I've actually put a little plot together on that. I think we're about 70% of the way there visually. I think we're 100% of the way there with audio. I think we're 100% of the way there in smell. I think we're just scratching the surface on touch and fooling your inner ear and acceleration. And the thing that I think will break the illusion will be food. I think that's going to be the hardest one to stimulate in VR. So, when you see the guy in the Matrix having a great bottle of wine and steak, that's going to be hard. Jaron Lanier. Just on some spiritual level, it just seems terribly wrong to say, well, we know enough about reality that living in this simulation is just as good. Giving up that mystery of what the real world is just seems like a form of suicide or something. Jim Clark. Plus, I'd rather have real sex than virtual sex. Nolan Bushnell. That's really a matter of haptics, a full haptic body suit, where the suit simulates temperature and pressure on your skin and various things.
Brenda Laurel. You know what? If the boys can objectify software instead of people, then it's good for everyone, except the boys.
Scott Hassan. That same type of technology will be used in teleoperated robots. Some people call them Waldos. Think of this device as a set of arms that rolls around, that's able to do stuff. Two hands that can be manipulated from afar. Let's say it fits where your dishwasher used to be. And whenever you need it, it comes out of there and it unfolds and it's operated by somebody else in another location that has expertise that you want at that time. You want dinner made? Well, it's just remote operated by a chef in some type of rig so that when they move their arms, the robot moves its arms in the exact same way. And that person is wearing these gloves so that whenever the robot touches something, they can feel that touch so that the person can pick up things and chop things and go into the refrigerator, open the doors as if they were there. Then that same Waldo, when that person is done with making dinner for you, instantly switches over to this other person who loves to clean up. And then they go and clean up the whole kitchen for you. It's the service economy, but it's in your own home, right? And so you basically have expertise on demand. So, well, something like that is going to be widespread in maybe 10 years. Nolan Bushnell. In 20 years, 80% of homes will have some kind of a robot.
Carol Bartz. Every inflection point really followed from the fact that you could make something affordable so that the public or industry could do something with it. You could get this in the hands of more people, which meant it was a bigger market, and on and on, and off you went.
Scott Hassan. They'll probably be the same price as a refrigerator. It's going to be one of those things. You got your car, you got your house, and you got your Waldo. But the cool thing about that is, once that kind of stuff comes out, then people will write all these applications that help those people do certain tasks. So you would install an app that you could click on the potato, and then your Waldo takes over and does it for you automatically, really fast, right? So you would have all these application makers making little things that can make someone's job easier, and then eventually you get to a point where you're not just controlling one of these Waldos, you will be controlling maybe 3 or 10 or 100 of these simultaneously. And you're more managing these Waldos now, not controlling them individually. Does that make sense? So you've got this huge scaling effect. Jim Clark. Yeah, I don't get excited about the virtual reality stuff, the car driving and robotics and stuff like that. It's just going to happen. The parts that really get my juices going are the human-computer interface through the nervous system and biology transformation. If I was a young man just getting a PhD, I would definitely do biology, because I think that's where it's going. A biologist armed with all this knowledge of computer science and technology can make a huge impact on humanity.
Adele Goldberg. If you were to predict the future based on seeing what is in the labs today and extrapolate, you would believe synthetic biology is the future, not electronics.
Andy Hertzfeld. Because the idea of bio being the next frontier is based on the silicon, really. There's about 100 billion neurons estimated in most people's heads. And the world knew that 30 years ago, and I remember thinking, boy, 100 billion, that's enormous. And now I think, 100 billion, hey, that's not so much, right? If there was a byte per thing, that's not even a terabyte. I have 30 terabytes on my desktop computer upstairs. So it's just that Moore's Law has gotten us to the point we're up to dealing with the biological scale of complexity. Alvy Ray Smith. Moore's Law means one order of magnitude every 5 years. That's the way I define it. And so what do you do with another 2 to 3 orders of magnitude increase in Moore's Law? We humans can't answer that question. We don't know. An order of magnitude is sort of a natural barrier. Or another way to say it is, if you've got just enough vision to go beyond the order of magnitude, you would probably become a billionaire. Jim Clark. I think that connecting humans to computers, having that interface, is increasingly going to be possible with a helmet that's measuring neurological signals from the brain and using that to control things. I'm pretty sure that 20 years from now, we're going to be well into getting the human-computer interface wrapped around a direct kind of brain-fed interface. Scott Hassan. We're going to tap right into the optic nerve and insert things that you don't see, but your brain doesn't know that you don't see them. We're just going to insert it right into your optic nerve. We really don't understand how memory works and stuff like that, but we understand somewhat how the optic nerve works, because it's just a cable going back to your brain. And you know, we know in theory how to insert things into it. So it's just a bunch of engineering work to make that happen. Jim Clark. And as time goes on, I think we'll get more and more refined at being able to map and infer and project those signals on the cortex, on the brain. And I feel as certain about that as I feel about anything. Larry Page. Eventually we'll have the implant where if you think about a fact, it will just tell you the answer. Scott Hassan. It's maybe 20 years away. I mean, it depends on how well the market takes up MR, mixed reality. If it really loves it, then it's going to be sooner. So if it's slow to pick up, then it's going to be longer. But I think eventually it's going to be there. Jim Clark. We will for sure be controlling computers with thoughts, and I think increasingly we're going to have kind of hybrid systems that are kind of biological and computer-like, and they're going to be there to make humans more effective at whatever. Tony Fidel. So then after that, I think it's really going to be how we co-evolve with AI. How do we as humans co-evolve with the artificial intelligence, machine learning kinds of technologies we are creating now? So look, chess champions, right? They got beat by Deep Blue back in the 90s, right? Kevin Kelly. When Garry Kasparov lost to Deep Blue, he complained to the organizers, saying, look, Deep Blue had access to this database of every single chess move that was ever done. If I had access to that same database in real time, I could have beat Deep Blue. So he said, I want to make a whole new chess league where you can play as a human with access to that database. And it's kind of like free martial arts, where you could play anywhere. You could play as a human with access. You could play it as a human alone, or you could play just as an AI alone. And he called that combination of the AI and the human, he called that a centaur. That team was a centaur. And in the last 4 years, the world's best chess player on the planet is not an AI. It's not a human. It's a centaur. It's a team. Tony Fidel. And so the chess champions have now co-evolved with the technology, and they've gotten smarter and better. Too many times do we get stuck in our own way of thinking, and these things can give us a shot in the arm to think dramatically different. It's like an Einstein showed up to help us, right? Kevin Kelly. Then I would say that in 30 years, people will be beginning to get used to the idea that you can have artificial consciousness. And when you give a body to an AI, you have a robot. Nolan Bushnell. Now, when the robot manifests self-awareness and then becomes aware of its existence and wants to self-preserve that, we've got some interesting issues that we're going to have to solve. What actions can it take in self-preservation? In a self-aware, self-programming, self-understanding, self-learning bot, can we truly control the limits on its actions? I think we're 50 years from that, but it's something that we're going to have to cross. Steve Wozniak. But even if it got smarter than us, it would take us on as partners, because we're the creators. You know, we're going to be its first friend. Right now, humans are still in control, and I've never heard anyone talk like, we're going to be out of control very soon. Tony Fidel. And then I think there's going to be another big split when we decide that biological means locomotion, or biological means manipulation. Because robots are incredibly fragile. They're hard to repair. They don't self-heal. And this is a crazy thing. We're going to figure out a way to actually turn the biological systems into the robots we want, that self-heal, that train more easily, that actually are much more energy efficient. Literally, the power efficiency of how much you eat versus how much energy you expend is so much more efficient in a biological system versus a mechanical system. So when we want superhuman things, how are they not going to be biological as opposed to a Megatron? And then there's going to be all kinds of societal and philosophical and governmental and ethical issues that are going to arise, just like with AI. Steve Wozniak. Hundreds of years downstream, machines will be a superior species. But what will we humans be doing? Can a human be satisfied just being taken care of like a family dog? Kevin Kelly. I kind of reject the idea of this super AI that becomes godlike as being unfeasible for a number of different reasons. But there will be aspects of it that I think may not be understandable, and that's one of the definitions of the singularity. Steve Wozniak. I have started feeding my dog filet steaks, because if I'm going to be a pet someday with all my needs, my comforts, my entertainment, my shopping, taken care of by computers, well, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. If they're going to do it, I want to be taken care of well. Kevin Kelly. Yet we're already there in a sense. It's already begun and we don't even recognize it. The first part of it has already been completed in the sense that 3 billion people are online. So it has begun. Steve Jobs. Humans are tool builders, and we build tools that can dramatically amplify our innate human abilities. Kevin Kelly. We are making a set of tools that will allow us humans to collaborate and cooperate, and to work together in making things and making things happen at a scale that was previously unimaginable, which is basically the scale of the planet. Steve Jobs. And I believe that with every bone in my body, that of all the inventions of humans, the computer is going to rank near the top, if not at the top, as history unfolds, and we look back, and it is the most awesome tool that we have ever invented. And I feel incredibly lucky to be at exactly the right place in Silicon Valley, at exactly the right time historically where this invention has taken form. Alvy Ray Smith. I was in the middle of Mountain View the other day, astonished at how this suburban town where graduate students at Stanford used to live in funky apartments is now this booming city. Silicon Valley is now a city. Downtowns that go all night long. Restaurants as far as you can see. You can't park anymore. Mark Porat. Silicon Valley was Santa Clara and Sunnyvale until it became Palo Alto. And then nobody lived in Menlo Park until they did. And Mountain View was a place you went to get some Asian food until it wasn't. Redwood City was a place that basically was working class until now. In some parts of Redwood City, you can't afford it. Oakland was too dangerous to even contemplate going into. And now it's the new Brooklyn. Alvy Ray Smith. In San Francisco, I've never seen skyscrapers go up so fast. It's completely changing the nature of San Francisco. John Markoff. The Salesforce Tower, this vertical campus that they are building, has surpassed the Transamerica building, surpassed the Bank of America Center. It dominates the skyline in San Francisco in a really overwhelming way. That's probably the strongest statement about how the valley has changed. It's certainly emblematic of a new era. We're getting these billion-dollar corporate statement headquarters now. It's not just Salesforce. It's Facebook, Apple, NVIDIA, even Google. Mark Porat. Eventually, one could see this Silicon Valley thing spreading up to Mill Valley, across to Richmond, down to Oakland and Berkeley, and then down through Fremont and Hayward, and then back down to San Jose. So the entire San Francisco Bay Area would be Silicon Valley. And that's a pretty good start. Steve Jobs. And we've come only a very short distance, and it's still in its formation. But already we've seen enormous changes. I think that's nothing compared to what's coming in the next 100 years. Scott Hassan. It's happening right now. In a 20-mile radius, the next 100 years is being invented. Charlie Ayers. And if you're smart enough, you see the low-hanging fruit everywhere. Scott Hassan. I know companies working on fusion power that is going to be a thing, and when you have fusion power, you can get water right out of the air. You can get food right out of the air. No problem. Fusion energy is going to make those things free, worldwide. Pretty much almost free. I think you're going to be able to live as long as you want. In the relatively near future. That's going to be solved. Mark Porat. You take what you see and you extrapolate and you push incrementally on things. Size, costs, capacity, functionality, whatever you push, until you push so hard there's a paradigm shift and things break. Scott Hassan. Economics is based on a certain number of people dying every once in a while, right? Well, that's not going to happen. Which is going to mess up everything. Fusion power is going to mess up a number of things. Mark Porat. And there's a discontinuity or more calamity and disruption, and then unintended consequences follow, which then produces another period of push, and then, and so on. Kevin Kelly. So, when I think of the future of Silicon Valley, I see it as still being the center of the universe, as defined by having the least resistance to new ideas,
and that's just its cultural history of being tolerant of wild ideas. Lee Felsenstein. Silicon Valley is a state of mind in a generalized physical area. Charlie Ayers. Silicon Valley is an energy and a focus and a vibration that consumes you and takes you over if you allow it to. Mark Porat. So the IQ points come here, and IQ points are sort of radioactive in a sense that if you press them hard enough, they create fusion. We have the universities, and we have the momentum, and we have the fusion model already working. Charlie Ayers. And you could be part of it. Or you can be against it. Scott Hassan. If any one of the technologies that I know of that are being developed right now in Silicon Valley do really well, the world is going to be an amazing place. But the really amazing thing that I think is probably going to happen is that they all are going to do well. So I'm a super optimist. Kevin Kelly. What we're really making here is something that is humanity plus. It's us plus the machines plus the planet. Scott Hassan. I hope that these quantum entanglement systems will allow you to transmit information faster than the speed of light. If it happens, that's going to allow us to colonize the whole entire galaxy and other galaxies. If that's actually really possible, it's going to be phenomenal. And that's being developed right now. Kevin Kelly. Not only will our tools tell us about ourselves, but they also will inform us as we invent new versions of ourselves. And it's going to have a huge effect on our own understanding and our own identity of who we are as humans. Scott Hassan. The world is going to be an amazing place, but it's going to be a pretty weird world. Kevin Kelly. And it won't ever end. We're just going to keep layering on more and more layers of connection and tools and abilities and intelligences to this thing that we are making. And that networked thing is the main event. Scott Hassan. It's going to be like nothing you see today. Realistically, nothing. Kevin Kelly. That's the big story. Am I going big enough for you? This has been a Hachette audio production of Valley of Genius, the uncensored history of Silicon Valley, as told by the hackers, founders, and freaks who made it boom. Written by Adam Fisher. Read by Pete Larkin. Produced by Cheryl Smith. Recorded by Demetrio Albano. Post-production by Beat Street NYC. Valley of Genius is also available in print and digital formats from 12, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2018 by Adam Fisher. Audio production copyright 2018 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.